Hello there. Today is Wednesday, April 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump threatens to close the U.S. border with Mexico.
We're going to have a strong border, or we're going to have a closed border.
Democrats will issue subpoenas to get the full Mueller report. Also ahead, one of the most popular classic rock bands in the U.S. is planning a historic concert. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump on Tuesday praised NATO countries for increasing their financial contributions to the Western alliance, but he hounded them to pay even more, saying America still shoulders a disproportionate share of the cost of protecting Europe. The president met with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, who was in Washington to mark the 70th anniversary of the organization formed to counter Russian aggression. The two leaders had kind words for one another. Stoltenberg said President Trump and the U.S. are 100% behind NATO.
We see that in the Congress. We see it in opinion polls. They all tell the same story. There is strong support for NATO in the United States from both sides. But that was also the clear message from President Trump today. He is a staunch supporter of NATO. At the same time, he conveys a clear message about the importance of that allies invest more, fair burden sharing, and NATO allies agree. We have actually all made the same pledge.
In the past, Trump has called NATO obsolete and suggested he might pull the U.S. out of the alliance if member stations didn't significantly boost their defense spending. Trump took credit for increasing spending. However, spending by the 29 NATO countries, which dropped after the end of the Cold War, has actually been rising since 2014, before Trump took office. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Trump assails Puerto Rican leaders for what he calls corrupt hurricane recovery. Trump takes credit for turning around NATO. Iran says U.S. sanctions impede flood rescue operations. And meatless burgers go mainstream. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump offered mixed signals Tuesday on whether he plans to close the U.S. southern border with Mexico to thwart the surge of undocumented migrants trying to seek asylum in the United States. No border closing decision has been made, and Trump later said he's ready to close it if he feels he has to.
Security is more important to me than trade. So we're going to have a strong border, or we're going to have a closed border.
The U.S. Chamber of Commerce said Monday that nearly $1.7 billion in goods and services flow across the U.S.-Mexico border each day, and nearly a half a million legal workers, students, shoppers, and tourists cross the dividing line between the two countries as well. Joining us to talk more about it is Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, professor at George Mason University. She specializes in U.S.-Mexico border relations, security, immigration, and human smuggling. Well, the president has been saying there is a crisis on the border, and he's described it as a national security issue, but it's sounding very much like there's a growing humanitarian crisis. What can you tell us?
We're definitely seeing a crisis at the border, but I see it as a manufactured crisis at the border. The president of the United States, Donald Trump, had forecasted this crisis since his campaign. He was talking about building a big, beautiful wall and the fact that MS-13 was coming with undocumented immigration from Central America and drugs and a threat to the United States was coming through the southern border. The construction of a wall has been a priority for his government to the extent that there was the biggest government shutdown in the history of the United States earlier this year, and now he declared a national emergency, and maybe he's going to shut down the border. What we're seeing, it's interesting because what happened with the caravanization of Central American migration started with the caravan, which are not new phenomena. The magnitude that I mentioned of the caravan late last year was something unprecedented as well, and gave the impression that there was an invasion and that people were fleeing, you know, in great, great numbers. This has not stopped. Somebody's organizing this caravan, and the smugglers have been responding to this new movement. So people are arriving. The voice has been spread out that you can reach the United States. You have to do it now. If it's not now, it's going to be never, because the president of the United States is going to shut the border very soon. So that has backfired to some extent, and more people are coming. But now, you know, Donald Trump is really having a point and can justify his policies, getting money for the wall, for the expansion of the detention center structures, the expansion of the military border industrial complex, more boots on the ground, more border patrol agents, more technology, more drones. This structure would benefit the contractors that provide those services. But definitely, the images that we have is definitely a reality. However, we need to consider and we need to think about this. Who is moving these caravans? These caravans are not organic. The situation in the Northern Triangle has not changed dramatically. The economic conditions and the gang expansion has been maintained relatively stable. The situation is really bad, but the communication and the utilization of social media to spread out the word that this is now or never, that you can ask for asylum and you will be released in the United States, that's a reality.
You're saying that these huge caravans of families and such crossing or trying to get asylum here in the U.S. at the Mexican border is not an organic thing that just evolved from them needing to flee, but rather there's some sort of movement to get them to be afraid that if they don't do it now, they won't ever be able to?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Having studied for several years social movements, I can see that these movements are not organic. Caravan organizers have been telling people you can go. They facilitate transportation. They facilitate information about how to apply for asylum, how to request asylum. These are your rights. You can do it and you will be released. Two more caravans are coming. The current administration, they are getting what they want to portray this image of a crisis at the border.
But are they fleeing because they are in a situation where there is violence and their children's lives are at risk and the conditions are so bad that compels them to follow what these people are saying?
That's definitely true. The conditions are terrible for them. That's a matter of fact. Conditions are very bad. They understand that once they get to the United States, they are going to get a job. There are pull and push factors, extreme poverty, violence in their neighborhood. The conditions are not good at all. They know that once they make it to the United States, they will get a job, and they are willing to do that because their life is going to change.
Aren't they concerned about this hard line that the Trump administration is taking on immigration?
Yes, but all of them know what is going on, and they know that the capacity of the detention centers in the United States is not enough, and they understand that many of them have been released. This is the information that they are getting from the smugglers, from the caravan organizers, and from what they know.
As you mentioned, yes, there is now a crisis on the border, but not necessarily the crisis the president has described as far as violent people coming in. These are mostly, it would appear, to be families. But these aid groups are saying that we are facing now a humanitarian crisis that's pretty dire. Some of these people have been in the same clothes for days, no food.
It is a big tragedy for everybody, for the United States, for Mexico, and especially for migrants. These people are leaving everything that they have, their homes, their belongings, everything. They don't know what's going to happen to them.
That's Guadalupe Correa Cabrera, professor at George Mason University. House Democrats will authorize subpoenas of the Department of Justice Wednesday in an attempt to gain access to a full version of the special counsel Robert Mueller's report on alleged collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia during the 2016 election. Attorney General Bob Barr has set a mid-April timeline for releasing a redacted version of the report that found no evidence of collusion. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more on the battle ahead on Capitol Hill.
Democrats' deadline for handover of the full Mueller report came and went.
If you look at every prior case of an independent counsel and a special counsel, they've turned over the entire report within a day or two. So what's taking place here is a sharp break from precedent, and it's indefensible.
The results of that 400-page report known publicly only through a four-page summary by Attorney General Bob Barr. President Trump previously said he has no objection to the report's release, but that appeared to change Tuesday.
I'll rely on the Attorney General to make decisions, but I will tell you, anything that's given to them will never be good enough. You could give them the more documents that they've ever seen, and it would never be good enough. So I think it's somewhat of a waste of time. This is just politics at a very low level.
Trump framing the effort as a personal attack by House Judiciary Chair Jerry Nadler and House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff.
We're going to insist that the entire report be produced, that we not get some either Barr version of the report or some heavily blacked out copy. There's no reason why the Attorney General can't seek court permission to disclose all the grand jury material, which could be a sizable portion of that report. That has been the precedent in Watergate. And at the end of the day, we're not going to allow this Attorney General handpicked by the president to oppose the obstruction case to bury Mueller's report and findings.
Both sides arguing the question over the report's release should rest on what is best for the American public.
They lost in 2016. They lost because they tried to convince all of America of something that we all knew was untrue, that the president had colluded with Russia. It was a total lie then. It's a total lie now. And they continue to lose on this issue. At some point, they have to decide that they're ready to move on like the rest of the country.
Democrats say transparency is key. And that can't happen if the report is delayed or heavily redacted.
I'd hate to think that the Attorney General is engaged in dilatory tactics in the hopes that as time goes by, public concern about what's in the report fades. And for that matter, he has more time to redact material that maybe is relevant and should be available to the Congress and the public.
Nadler will have the choice to use the subpoenas following the Wednesday vote. He has also called for Barr to immediately appear before Congress. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's ruling party on Tuesday appealed election results in Istanbul and Ankara, claiming irregularities in the voting cost them mayorships in both cities. Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, or AKP, won a majority of votes throughout Turkey in Sunday's local elections, but trailed in Istanbul, the country's economic hub, and Ankara, the capital. If the initial outcomes hold, it would be a political setback for the Turkish leader, who campaigned extensively for his party's candidates. Quite a setback. And he's now appealing, claiming irregularities. Ikan Erdemir, senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, joins us to talk about this. So how big of a setback is this for Erdogan?
This is a major setback for the Turkish President Erdogan and his Islamist-rooted Justice and Development Party. Before the local elections last Sunday, Erdogan's municipalities used to control 75% of Turkey's GDP and a vast majority of the population. But given the changes in the municipality, the swing vote, now the pro-secular Republican People's Party controls over 60% of the GDP and almost half the population. This, of course, is a major setback because municipalities are key in Turkish politics in providing spoils to the followers of political parties. And from this point on, the ruling AKP will have a difficult job in providing these spoils to the party's loyalists.
What happens now with his appeal?
Now, there are a lot of question marks. There has been a number of appeals, both at the sub-provincial and provincial level. Some of the appeals have been turned down, and there were calls for recounts, which further complicates the matter. And some of those calls for recounts have been turned down by the Supreme Election Council. So right now, there seems to be a legal deadlock. And as you can imagine, this is deepening the crisis, not only at the political level, but given the economic crisis in Turkey, also at the economic level. You know, investors are watching with great concern to see whether the Turkish government will concede in the country's economic powerhouse, Istanbul, in the country's political capital, Ankara, and its tourism capital, Antalya. So it is quite a chaotic situation as we speak.
I understand there have also been some issues with regard to the United States and weapons for Turkey. What is that all about?
Turkey is about to buy from Russia an air defense system called the S-400. And this is prompting the U.S. to block the delivery of F-35 stealth fighters to Turkey. So this is the crisis that we have for the last 2 days, as the U.S. started taking first steps in blocking the delivery. On Monday, you know, this is the day after elections. Clearly, they waited until the elections. Pentagon notified Turkish counterparts that some of the equipment required for the transfer of the planes and for the training in Turkey will not be sent. So this was like seen as the first step toward blocking the delivery of F-35. So this is like another low point in bilateral affairs.
What was the reasoning behind the block?
S-400 air defense system is a Russian system. It's not interoperable with NATO equipment. And furthermore, it can compromise the stealth characteristics of F-35 jets if S-400s and F-35s are operated alongside one another. And this has been a concern raised not only by the U.S., but also by other NATO allies who are also procuring F-35 jets. And, you know, Turkey has tried to negotiate with the U.S., tried to give certain assurances, but I think such assurances haven't been convincing so far. So as of Monday, we see Washington beginning to take concrete steps to block the delivery of F-35s to Turkey. And this is more than just an issue about, you know, Turkey as a customer not being able to procure F-35s, because Turkey is also a partner in the production. There are 10 Turkish companies in the supply chain producing over 800 parts worth over $12 billion. And so this is going to be a major loss for Turkey and also a new low point in bilateral affairs.
That's Aykan Erdemir, Senior Fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. British Prime Minister Theresa May says she'll seek a further delay to the country's exit from the European Union to allow more time for Parliament to pass a deal on the terms of its withdrawal. To date, British lawmakers have three times rejected the deal that May's negotiators agreed to after 2 years of talks with the EU. Britain was originally due to leave the bloc by March 29th, but May got approval from the EU for a short extension to give her government more time to find a solution that Parliament could support. And while the process has dragged on, Parliament sought its own path forward. But in a series of votes Monday, lawmakers struck down four possible paths. The closest that came to passing was a proposal to have Britain withdraw from the EU but remain in a customs union. Earlier, I talked about all of it with Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, asking how this further delay is playing out.
Well, first of all, in Europe, they want more details. It's one thing for Theresa May to say she wants more time to deal with, but she's not sure how much time. The European leaders have all said, we need to know what you're doing. Otherwise, on the 12th of April, you will be leaving the European Union. There is a little bit of goodwill, particularly among some of the top officials at the European Commission. Jean-Claude Juncker has said he's working night and day to stop any type of what's known as a hard Brexit, that is the United Kingdom falling out without an agreement. But on the other side, you've got the French President Emmanuel Macron, who has said just a few hours ago that France and the EU will not be hostage to what's going on in the UK. And if the UK cannot decide what it wants, then it's going to have to leave. The next big date is the 12th of April, when there is going to be that summit meeting in Brussels. And that's when Theresa May says she will go, she will ask for extra time, but they in turn will say, well, what are you going to do? She has reached out to the opposition parties in the United Kingdom to have cross-party talks, try and find out some if there is some way to move forward. But certainly, as it looks at the moment, the alternative proposals that are there have been there for the last almost 3 years since the referendum. It hasn't gotten any further, and it seems to be at least a bit more of a stalemate, and Theresa May now trying to land the ball in the court of the opposition Labour Party so that if that fails, perhaps she can blame them.
Is it possible still that there could be Brexit without a deal, and how much chaos would that cause?
It is possible that it could be on the 12th of April, no deal Brexit, that the European Union is down to 27 members, United Kingdom leaves. It wouldn't create that much chaos, confusion in Europe itself, because in the last 2 weeks, the European Union, or 27 countries, has been going through and making clear all the preparations that they have been making for Brexit. That includes everything from what they're going to do at the ports, what happens to United Kingdom citizens who are living in Europe at the time. All those sorts of mechanisms have already been put in place. However, on the other side, when it comes to United Kingdom, it does look as though it will be chaos, because they haven't really put in place any of the mechanisms for dealing with how goods are going to come in and out of the United Kingdom, what's going to happen when trucks carrying goods from France go and land at ports in the United Kingdom. That hasn't been done. And also, just today, it's been revealed that no British official has come to France and spoken to the French port authorities for how to deal with any case of this no-deal Brexit. So it could well happen. And after that, there is nothing else. And because the European Union has said, we've agreed a deal, we've agreed a withdrawal agreement, there is no other deal. They say very clearly, we spent 2 years negotiating that deal, we did it in good faith, you agreed it, now you can't get it through Parliament, that's not our problem.
What about the possibility of a second referendum to potentially reverse course and stay in the EU?
That is one of the possibilities that the European Union has said it would look very favorably upon giving the United Kingdom extension for.
Why would the UK put forth an election such as the decision to leave the EU without having a plan to actually follow through with it?
This is a big problem, and this is indeed the fact that no one is taking any sort of lead, whether it comes to Brexit, whether it comes to any other sort of trading arrangement with the European Union. There just is no clear thinking about where to go beyond that. It's a very valid question, but no one has really thought it through. No one has really explained it to the electorate, because none of this was really thought through, and no one really, back in June 2016, when this first referendum was held, no one really knew what all this meant. So fair question, and really there are no answers to it at the moment.
That's Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Malawi has appealed for international aid for nearly a million people affected by floods from Cyclone Idai. Authorities say people in cyclone-affected areas are in dire need of food, water, shelter, and sanitation. Lamek Messina reports from Lantyre.
Malawi's appeal is for aid targeting 162,000 households in areas worst hit by Cyclone Idai's flooding waters. Official figures show the cyclone killed 60 people, injured more than 600, and displaced hundreds of thousands, many to temporary camps. Minister of Homeland Security in Malawi, Nicholas Dagusi, says they are in dire need of food, shelter, and sanitation.
Our intention is to tell the world that Malawi has a big problem regarding the natural disaster that has befallen us. It's an appeal to both monetary and humanitarian assistance, to the international world, even people of goodwill, to come for an assistance. There is desperation in the camps.
Malawi's Department of Disaster Management says the country needs about $43 million for cyclone relief, but Malawi authorities say they have secured half of that amount. Catherine Boza is a flood-displaced villager in Chihuahua district. She says there are problems at the camp because of food shortages. They were initially given maize flour in a cup of water to cook porridge, says Boza, and later were given a plate of maize flour. Recently, she says, they have been given two basins of maize flour. But most of the time, says Boza, they sleep without eating anything. Flood victim Paul Mandiamba says most of the assistance they have received is from politicians running for office in the upcoming May elections. He says when they come with a bag of maize, they tell us to eat together in a group. This is not practical, says Mandiamba, because some of us have four children, while others have five children. It is still not enough. In many areas in Malawi's East Bank, providing cyclone relief aid is still a problem because of damaged roads and bridges. Maria Jose Torres is a country coordinator for the United Nations Development Programme. She says efforts are being made to help Malawi meet the needs of flood-affected people.
The United Nations is working towards implementing the plan, and we are already mobilizing from our Central Emergency Response Fund. That is based in New York, $3.2 million, and acknowledging that actually it's not enough, but we will continue with the efforts to bring more attention.
Cyclone Idai hit central Mozambique in early March, swamping entire villages with heavy rains that flooded parts of southern Malawi and Zimbabwe. Malawi President Peter Mutharika in early March declared half of the country's districts disaster areas. Lameki Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
The Eagles will perform their 1976 hit Hotel California, the album, in its entirety in concert for the first time ever. Live Nation says it will take place on September 27th and 28th at MGM Grand Garden Arena in Las Vegas. Tickets will go on sale through Ticketmaster on April 12th. Don Henley, Joe Walsh, and Timothy B. Schmidt will be joined by Deacon Frey and Vince Gill for what will be the group's only North American performances of 2019. Founding member Glenn Frey, Deacon's father, died in 2016. Hotel California is the third best-selling U.S. album in history.
One smell of colitas rising up through the air. Up ahead in the distance, I saw a shimmering light.
And you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Then she lit up a candle, and she showed me the way. There were voices down the corridor. I thought I heard them say, welcome to the Hotel California. We'll be right back. side. We are all just prisoners here of our own device. And in the master's chambers, they gathered for the feast.
This is VOA News.